Okay, welcome everybody who's either watching this live or after the fact. This is the first office hours session for the class Anarcho-Capitalism offered by the Ludwig von Mises Institute through its online Mises Academy, and today's date is August 4th, 2012. And we've already got a question right out of the chute, so let me go ahead and answer that. And as always, people who are trickling in, just go ahead and get your questions typed up and submit them in the chat box so I know how to pace myself. Okay, so George asks, in Edward Stringham's essay, Market Chosen Law, he quotes John Hassness as saying, quote, if human beings had the wisdom and knowledge generating capacity to be able to describe how a free market would work, that would be the strongest argument for central planning, end quote. Now back to George. I see his point, but most people don't trust free markets. The greater the freedom, the lower the trust. What is the best way, in your view, to get people to trust something that doesn't exist and has never existed? Leonard Reed's essay, I, Pencil, has had limited success. Okay, so that's a good question. Let me just make sure, George, that everyone understands what John Hassness was saying and why Stringham thought that was a good thing to quote. So one is always faced with the problem if you say, oh, we should get the government out of sector X, then people say, oh, well, what would replace it? We understand right now how the government works and we understand what we're getting there, but there's uncertainty. If you say we should just pull back and not have the government provide some service or product because you think the market would do it better, give us some assurance. What would the market give us instead? And the problem with that kind of question, even though it's a perfectly reasonable question at first glance, is that it kind of misses the point. That one of the reasons you don't want to have the government provide something in general is that that necessarily will restrict the provision of that service to a few people. So I think George, I mean, for me, Rothbard had a great approach to this, is he picked something that just about everybody thinks the market should provide. He picked, like, shoes or something like that. And he was saying, imagine if everybody had just grown up in a world where the government monopolized the production of shoes, where that was just, everyone just took it for granted that, oh yeah, you have the, you know, the market makes computers and cars and cans of tuna fish, but clearly you need the government to provide the military, courts, roads, and shoes. I mean, you can't even imagine how could the market and the government does a good job. It takes some tax money and it pays people to make, you know, has companies that get government contracts to make shoes. And if there's a shortage and people need more size 8 shoes, well, then the government just puts in its plans for next year to have more size 8 shoes being made. And people have elections and they give feedback and they have hotlines set up to give their preferences to the government about what kind of shoes they'd like. And, hey, maybe we should have more shoes for tennis. And so the government takes it into consideration, and they have a whole body of experts that they consult with to determine. So if you had that whole apparatus and everybody grew up in a world where it was just taken for granted that, oh, yeah, shoes are something the government makes, and then somebody, some economist comes along and goes, this is crazy. This is so inefficient. You could use society's resources much better if you directed it through private channels and had entrepreneurs making decisions about what kind of shoes to make. There'd be more variety. There'd be better feedback that if customers didn't like a certain shoe, it would stop being made. Whereas right now, look at all these horror cases of shoes that were very uncomfortable and ended up giving people back pain and blah, blah, blah. And it took 3 years for the government to even acknowledge there was a problem. There was a cover-up. And they were suppressing all of the medical evidence that these shoes they were making were bad. And you know, you wouldn't have to worry about that. That kind of stuff would get taken care of so much more quickly in a free market for shoes. And you could give all these generic arguments. And when people, but people said, well, but how many size 8 shoes for men that were dressy would be made next quarter under a free market system. Tell me the exact number. And the honest response from the economist would be to say, I have no idea. In fact, I'm not even sure that size 8 dress shoes would be made. They probably would be, but I don't know that. We have to let the market decide. For all we know, maybe that's inefficient. Maybe there should be much broader sizes, you know, like a unit that encompasses the people right now that the government has sizes 8, 9, and 10. Maybe it would just be a size large. We don't know. Probably wouldn't be the case, but we just don't know. In reality, it would probably be the other way around. Probably in reality, in order to make things easier, the government would just have things like extra large, large, medium, and small for shoes, and then so that whereas the market would come up with much finer gradations. But the point is we don't know. We don't know what the efficient number of shoe sizes is. And certainly we wouldn't expect the government planner to come up and hit that number magically. So, and if the person pushed it, you know, they could say right now, with the government running shoe production, we have all these distribution centers. So we have places where they make the shoes in mass quantities, and then they have government trucks that take them out to these various outlets, and people go there, and they have the tickets that the government issued them in exchange for work, or that they gave them as part of their social spending. You know, so people got general tax revenues, and then the government prints up these little tickets to entitle everybody to a certain number of shoes per month or something like that. Then they distribute them to families based on need or whatever they do. So we understand now how it is that shoes get made and how they get into the hands of the final user under a market system. How would that work? I mean, okay, I can kind of understand how a market-owned business might make shoes, but then how do you know that they're going to get into the hands of the people who need them? And you'd say, well, people would go to work and they would get money, and then they'd go to stores and buy shoes, and so then the store owner would have the incentive to go to the wholesaler and say, I want to buy a bunch of your shoes and keep them in my store because I have customers. And well, how would they get them there? Well, they would hire people who own trucks to come ship them. You know, there'd be a market for that. And it would actually be more efficient, and they would save money, they would use less gasoline, and diesel, whatever. And it would just sound crazy to somebody who had never seen it with his own eyes. He would be, you guys with your big theories, I live in the real world, and that sounds like a very risky plan, and there's 19 different assumptions you're making with that, and if any one of those things didn't work, the whole thing would come crashing down and nobody would have shoes anymore. So that really, you know, what if there's some rogue business that goes around putting tax in shoes? You can't stop that. You don't know that won't happen. Whereas with the government, you know, we have rules in place. That the government officially has a rule that you have to make shoes to try to help people with, and that's comfortable. There's nothing in your system, Murphy, that would stop people from just making shoes. You know, some rich guy could make shoes that have shards of broken glass in them. And then you'd say, why would he do that? That would be dumb. He'd be throwing away millions of dollars. Why would he do that? Well, you can't be sure he won't. You see what I'm saying? So as crazy as that is, that's exactly how a free market economist who's an anarchist feels when talking about privatizing judicial and military services. That people want them to spell out exactly how the new system would look, and they come up with all these crazy objections that would never happen, and yet you're on the defensive and you have to somehow prove that that won't happen when really your answer is that would be unprofitable. Why would anybody do that? And yet they say, well, that's not good enough, even though we have documented cases of police brutality and corrupt judges and U.S. soldiers literally committing war crimes in other countries. And yet that doesn't matter because at least we know there are sometimes criminals who get punished by them. So we kind of know the system works. Now, and there's no, people have no sense of how awful the current system might be because they have nothing to compare it to. Just like if the government really did centrally plan shoe manufacture and distribution, people would say, well, having shoes is better than being barefoot. Having these government shoes is better than nothing. So the government, you know, at least we know the government works. And I'm not sure if the market would do it better or not, but at least we know the government system works. And that's how they would talk. I mean, I just saw the Boston Fed. Hey, Clark, you got to be a little more quiet, buddy. The Boston Fed just came out with this thing to tell all the good things that government does. And one of their examples was municipal water service. And I'm going to write an article on this in the near future. But just to summarize what I'm going to say, it's laugh out loud funny. Like, if you're a normal mainstream economist, you can make a case for government at the city, local level, regulating utilities like electricity and water distribution and natural gas and that kind of stuff, because there's an alleged market failure where, it would be just wasteful if you had 15 different competing water companies who are trying to sell you the service of bringing water into your house. Like, so you turn your sink on and water comes out and you flush your toilet and the water leaves. If you had this a totally free market and that kind of thing, some economists would say there'd be wasteful overproduction, that there'd be all these different companies having their own pipe systems laid side by side so that the Acme water company would have pipes running to your next door neighbor and the other guy down the street, and the Universal water company would have separate pipes side by side going to you and your other neighbor, and so you got all these pipes in the ground, and it's just very expensive. And so it'd be more efficient if you just had the government grant a monopoly for water provision within a certain neighborhood, so that only one set of pipes needs to get built. But then, because of the danger of monopoly pricing, the government also regulates how much they can charge. So they don't just give somebody a monopoly and say, charge whatever the market will bear. They give someone a monopoly and then say, but you can only charge such and such rates for water. And that's the system we have right now in many places. And like I said, you could, if you wanted to, come up with a mainstream economics argument to justify that, to show that that outcome is better than having it left open to the free market. I think that's wrong, but that's a plausible argument to make. It's coherent, at least. What this Boston Fed piece did was to contrast the current system where you have government-regulated utilities bringing in water with a world where you don't have indoor plumbing. They actually went back in time and looked at the world before the government came in and had municipal water service, where housewives had to take buckets and walk down to the lake or something and then walk and carry buckets by hand. And that's what they said would be the outcome if it weren't for the government. I mean, it's so intellectually dishonest, I can't even believe they said that. If a fifth grader said that on a paper, I would give him an 85% at best and say, okay, I get where you're coming from, but come on, the market would clearly have companies bringing water into your house so you didn't have to go down to the lake with a bucket. And the only issue is, would they be charging you more or less per gallon than the government monopoly does? The issue would not be the government is the only entity that can give you water to your house. I mean, I'm still astounded that that's what the bot. And this isn't from this isn't like Matt Iglesias wrote an op-ed. This isn't a publication that the Boston District Federal Reserve Bank put out, presumably written by PhD economists. So it's just incredible. All right, so I kind of went off on a tangent there. So George, I don't know if I think what you'd have to do, George, is what we have been doing is it's a whole spectrum of things in terms of making the case. And the first thing, somebody who voted for Obama is not going to become a market anarchist overnight. I think rather what you do is get people to realize on certain things that aren't so crazy that, oh, wait, look how government messes things up. So, maybe we don't need a monopoly on first-class mail delivery because people can see that there's FedEx and UPS, and it's not so hard to imagine. What if you allowed FedEx and UPS to deliver first-class, what we call first-class mail, too? Would that be the end of the world? And people could kind of see, well, no. The worst that would happen is it might cost $2 to send a letter down the street, which is crazy, but that's what people might worry about. But there's not an issue of you couldn't mail a letter anymore. And then you'd start warming people up that way. And then, or education, well, schooling is a better term, that people can imagine what it would be like if you didn't have government schools. And a lot of people would think it'd be horrible and the poor people wouldn't get taught anything, but they can see how, there's pros and cons. and you warm people up like to that, and then things that are obvious like shoe production, hopefully most people would recognize it would be crazy if the government literally were the monopoly provider of shoes. They would still want there to be regulations, but I think most people think it makes sense for shoes to be produced by private companies in a capitalist society, that then they would say where the government has all kinds of regulations to make sure the shoes are safe and the employees at the shoe factories get treated fairly and that kind of stuff. But most people understand you don't want to have a central planner in shoes. So if they get that and then they're on board with sort of lukewarm free market stuff, then I think it's easier to start drawing analogies to a private legal system. Okay, Susan L. asks, is anarcho-capitalism a system you see is feasible for the United States? If so, how on earth would you get the current power structure to accept the change? The progressives, in quotation marks, have been infiltrating for generations. Are you expecting it to take that long or longer to transform the U.S.? I don't want to disappoint anybody, but I don't predict that the United States will be anarcho-capitalist in my lifetime. So if that's what you're asking me, that's my answer. What I think could happen is, with various technological advances and things, there could be pockets on Earth that are relatively, or in outer space, that are relatively free in the sense that we use that term. So, you know, if there's floating cities or something, or they build underwater things, or they put floating space stations, or they put bases on the moon or on Mars or something like that, I can imagine a free society, in our sense of the term, being there. And then that would help, because then it would be an actual working example. Because right now, the biggest trump card opponents of this sort of thing have to play is to say, well, point to an example where it works. There is no. We know government works. Maybe you don't like the way it works, but we know you can have a society with a government, and we can see in history that, oh, too much government is bad, but we have any historical examples of a place that had no government and just stayed like that forever and was a prosperous society. They either got conquered by somebody else, or they fell apart from internal war, or blah, blah, blah. And right now, the places where the government temporarily falls are hellholes. Right? Nobody wants to go live in a place right now that has literally no government, because that means it's in the middle of a civil war or something like that. So that is a very hard argument to overcome for most people. And you can make arguments, and we'll talk about it later in the course, things like, well, actually, places that had relatively little government historically were pretty law-abiding, and as awful as you think anarchy would be, it's better than North Korea or the Soviet Union or Communist China was under Mao. So if what we're trying to do is avoid really awful stuff, it's safer to have anarchy. And even like Somalia is better now under anarchy or close to anarchy than it was when it had a government, and that's why their government fell, because it was so awful. So, you know, we can make arguments like that that I think are fine, but it's true that it's a little bit awkward that we can't just point to it working. And it's largely theoretical in terms of how we describe how this kind of society would work, and it would be so much easier if we could just point and say, well, it works over there. And so that's, I think, what would have to happen is you'd have to have a society that really is living up to the sort of things we talk about in our books and lectures, that works and that's around for a few decades and has been attacked by some government military and won, and that they don't and they have criminals in their society, and there are crimes, but the crime rate is extremely low, so the people can say, it's not like they're just lucky and for some reason they don't have criminals and that's why it works, but it wouldn't work over here. You have to show, no, they actually do have once in a while a serial killer, and he gets apprehended much more quickly than under the status system. And they do have, you know, religious conflicts and people from different faiths, and they do have terrorists and blah, blah, blah. but look how their system neutralizes those threats so much more quickly than the other places around the world that were under government rule. So you would need that, but like I said, you would need it to be in existence for at least a couple decades. They would have needed to fend off a major government invasion attempt. Otherwise, people would say, oh, that's just a fluke, and they're going to fail any day now. And so just by definition, that what I just described to you is going to take 50 years to happen, because it's going to take 20 years for the technology to make it feasible. Right now, you can't have people living in large cities outside of Earth. And to have like a giant floating city that's out in the middle of the Pacific that, I don't know, either runs on solar power, has a nuclear generator, and harvests a bunch of fish, and does financial transactions, and that's what their GDP comes from, you know, I don't know what they're going to do. You can imagine that, but I don't think that's going to happen in the next 5 years. I think that's definitely something. And it has enough surface-to-air missiles and can lay mines and stuff to prevent the U.S. Navy from just obliterating it if they wanted to. I think that's not going to happen for another decade at least. And then, like I said, it wouldn't be enough that it exists. They would have to be there and be prosperous and start holding their own in terms of international trade and have at least a million people and fend off a major attack. And that's the only thing then that would start making regular people think, huh, that looks like it actually works. And so that, again, for all that to happen is at least several decades. And then that would just start shaping the debate. It wouldn't overnight make everybody an anarchist. So, again, to answer your question directly, no, I don't see the U.S. becoming anarcho-capitalist in my lifetime. The thing is, though, it's one little comment I'll make about the way you're phrasing the question. You're saying to get the current power structure to accept the change, the power structure would never accept the change. It's never that we would convince the people who right now are running the mechanisms of state power in the U.S. government and other places around the world, they would never say, oh, yeah, okay, we'll relinquish this power. We see now the light and we'll all be better. That would never happen. What would happen is their system would crumble because the general public would stop believing in it, and they would realize we don't need these people. These people are parasites. That's the way it would happen. And I'm saying to get the average person to actually trust in a market system instead of the government system, I think they would need to see it with their own eyes working. And even then, it would be tough. I mean, there's because the government would do all kinds of propaganda and stuff to convince people. I mean, they would suppose there were some floating city somewhere, like the kind of thing that Patrick Friedman, if you guys are familiar with that, the seasteading project. So Milton Friedman's grandson, Patrick Friedman, in case you guys don't know, has this project that I think Peter Thiel, is Peter Thiel, I don't know how you pronounce that guy's name, T-H-I-E-L, something like that. The PayPal founder? Anyway, that guy's loaded, and he gave a bunch of money to Patrick Friedman's seasteading initiative. So they're on the West Coast, and their deal is technologically you can make a platform that floats, and you can have people living on it, and you can just keep expanding it. So in principle, there's no reason you couldn't just go build some floating, I don't know if you want to call it an island or a cruise ship that never docks anywhere, that just is out there in the middle of the ocean and is self-sufficient. Like they generate their own power somehow, and you know they get supplies from cargo ships and stuff occasionally, and then whatever. I don't know if they have desalination plants or whatever. You know, take ocean water and get the salt out so people drink. I don't know exactly how it's supposed to work, but it's a serious thing. Like they're not just doing science fiction. They actually want to sell space on these deals, and so that at some point people all go and live on this thing. So. I forgot where I was going with that. So imagine, whatever, 20 years from now, there are a bunch of these floating things that have 100,000 people apiece, and they're fairly libertarian in our sense of the term, you can imagine all the crazy stuff the U.S. media would be saying about them. You know, they'd be saying, oh my gosh, there's like they sell organs and stuff, and they have markets for babies, and it's the most disgusting, perverse things that happen at their brothels, and there's all kinds of rampant drug abuse, and and they would be just painting this place as this horrible, like Mad Max world, when in fact it might be the most peaceful place on earth. But that's what they would do, and if you didn't go there yourself, you wouldn't, and the government would probably have prohibitions, like, oh, you can't go there because there's known terrorists who work there, and they're financing attacks on the U.S., and so no one's allowed to send any money there, and no one can go visit, because they wouldn't want you to go see it with your own eyes. So that's the kind of stuff they would do to try to minimize the propaganda value. Just like the people in North Korea right now, most of them have no idea how poor they are, because the government of North Korea has done a good job blocking the information from the outside. Because if the people in North Korea realized how poor they were compared to the rest of the world, that government would fall overnight. But the government keeps the people in the dark, so they're just scrounging for food, and they don't have time to sit around and be philosophical about the nature of government. They're trying not to starve to death. And they don't realize that that's not just the way the world is, that, no, that's what happens because you're sadistic government. So the point, Susan, I'm trying to get at is all the governments who are in power have to convince their subjects that it makes sense for them to be in power. And the way you would change that is not to convince the people in charge necessarily, but to convince either the lower levels of government employees or the general public that this system needs to stop. Okay, Tate Fegley asks, in terms of the Hastas paper, I'm having difficulty making the distinction between customary law, common law, and consent-based law. Also, his critique of consent-based law seems to be grounded on the idea that it would require constructing the world anew. However, in For a New Liberty, Rofford states that since we have a body of common law principles to draw on, the task of reason in correcting and amending the common law would be far easier than trying to construct a body of systematic legal principles de novo out of thin air. Is Hastas' criticism fair? Well, I understand what he's saying, I'll put it that way. And that's part of my concern, too, is at times Rothbard does make it sound like what we need to do for a free society is we have to have all the judges agree with the kind of law that I spell out in my book, The Ethics of Liberty. And so they need to all agree with my logical deduction that, first of all, let's think it through. Okay, people clearly own themselves. Let's think it through. Oh, clearly there's homesteading. Let's think it through. Clearly we have voluntary exchange of those property titles. Let's think it through. Oh, clearly if somebody aggresses against me, I get to do twice as much back to him. Let's think it through. Oh, with pollution, the way we solve that is and, you know, Rothbard thinks that just using your reason and knowledge of economics and blah, 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 you can build up this core body of libertarian legal codes, and that in a free society, well, the judges have to all use those codes and when they make decisions. And it doesn't seem to be a large enough acknowledgement of the fact that, well, in every other area, we rely on the market to sort of coordinate dispersed knowledge or dispersed expertise, and the resulting outcome is not something any individual could have known in advance. And it seems like at times that element of what we normally talk about with markets does not get used when we talk about market-produced law. And so that's, I think, what Hastas is worried about. So, I mean, Rothbard is right. So, I mean, that's a bit of a caricature. So really, Rothbard is not saying he should be the central planner of the legal code, and he's just going to lay down the law like he's Moses, and then all the judges have to follow it, or else it's not a free society. That's actually not what Rothbard is saying, but it is true that I didn't see much discussion in Rothbard's writing on this stuff of showing how there might be areas where we don't know what the answer is, and we would need the private legal system to discover what the answer is. It doesn't, I don't see that kind of thing stressed too much in Rothbard. Clark, you got to be a little bit more quiet, buddy. And I think, and from like a Rothbardian, Hans Hoppian viewpoint, I think they're a little concerned about talk like that because they're worried, like they don't like David Friedman's approach, because David Friedman, in their mind, goes too far the other way. Friedman is, in his The Machinery of Freedom, is David Friedman's book where he gets into anarcho-capitalism. For people who don't know, David Friedman is Milton Friedman's son and the father of Patrick Friedman, who I was talking about before. So David Friedman and his treatment of what we would call market-produced law is, like, you don't know what his own views are at all. He's just saying, well, whatever, the market would just pick whatever laws would be most profitable. And so, you know, if a lot of people believed in the death penalty, well, then that's what the profitable outcome would be. If a lot of people didn't believe in the death penalty, then that's what, then it wouldn't be a death penalty. And that's how it would work. And he, Friedman, like, goes through the mechanics of the market for these things and explains how you would see various legal rules either being supported or falling away because of the profit and loss test. So Rothbard was horrified by that kind of approach, because he was saying, so according to Friedman, if enough people in society thought it was fine to kill redheads just for sport, and there weren't enough redheads or people who sympathized with them to be willing to pay enough to make that not the profitable outcome, then you could have a free market society where redheads didn't have legal protection, and you could just go shoot them. And to Rothbard, that sounded crazy. He said, that's not a free society. So there is that tension where, on the one hand, as an economist, you want to be able to say, oh, I think the private legal system without government interference would produce laws. You know, we can't even anticipate what the laws would be. We have to let the market determine that because we're not central planners and we don't have enough information. But on the other hand, as someone who has general views of what's just or not, and if you don't like the government system, in other words, a real hardcore libertarian like Rothbard, who just burns with passion about freedom, he doesn't object to the state system of law because, oh, that's inefficient. I bet you there's a Pareto improvement possible here if we just had the government get out of the way and have private provision of these services. No, it's that Rothbard thinks there's horrible injustices being committed. So that when the police beat somebody up, Rothbard's criticism isn't, oh, well, that's not a profitable outcome. Under a market system, resources would be allocated differently. The policeman's boot wouldn't be going into that guy's face. It would instead be used to lift fertilizer onto a farm, and that would produce more crops. So clearly, we have more total output if we have one fewer face bashing and one more bushel of corn being harvested. That's not the way you're thinking about it. You're thinking, he's beating up that guy. He's kicking him in the face. That's a crime. So you see the distinction of the two approaches. And in practice, neither Rothbard nor Friedman is that caricature, right? I mean, David Friedman presumably would personally be upset if he saw a policeman beating somebody to death. And Rothbard, by the same token, doesn't actually think that he, Murray Rothbard, should be the central planner, but he knows everything, and he knows how every single legal decision should go. No, he would acknowledge his own limitations and that you need to have the expertise of judges and so forth. All right, let me move on. We're going to talk more about this kind of stuff in week two, so let me defer more pontificating on that kind of question. Okay, Christopher Hendricks says, also with Hasness's article on the issue of depoliticized versus consent-based law, he talks about law based on custom that are not necessarily explicitly agreed to by all the participants. Could this customary law violate property rights? For instance, customary laws against sodomy violate a person's right to engage in consensual sexual relations. And if not, what mechanism restrains the customary law from making such attacks on rights? Okay. All right. So the issue of customary law means, I mean, the distinction there, customary law versus state-formed legislation. I mean, there the issue is, before you had a nation state in our modern sense of the term, there were still laws. So even if you, when the European imperialists came over and discovered Native American Indians, it depends what how you want to define the terms, but someone could be quite reasonable in saying those Native American Indians were not living in anarcho-capitalism, that they had law that was not purely consensual, that somebody born in that society could grow up and never have agreed, you know, and maybe they go do something that violates what the tribal elders think is allowed because of the, you know, their religious views or something. Maybe, and I'm engaging in a stereotype. I don't really know much about that culture, those cultures. But suppose, you know, they think that this the spirit of the eagle is offended if you try to go too high, because man's not supposed to fly. That's reserved for the winged animals. And so some teenager who grows up in the tribe keeps climbing trees, and they keep telling him, you got to stop doing that. You're not supposed to do that. And the punishment for that is, you know, the first time you do it, we whip you, and the second time you do it, we beat you senseless, and the third time you do it, we kill you. So that would be customary law, but clearly that kid never agreed to that. And so that's, I think, the kind of distinction Haskins is making, whereas consent-based law is more things you did agree to. So, like, if you're, and I don't know exactly what Haskins, where he draws the boundary line, but the kind of thing he may mean is, if I'm going to hire, you know, I'm a business and someone comes to apply to work at my firm, we have as part of the labor contract, the employment agreement, we say, now I'm going to pay you this much per month, and you're going to show up for work and do X, Y, and Z, and you get this much vacation time, and and I'm going to fund your health insurance, or probably wouldn't do that in a free market. Probably people would just get paid and buy their own health insurance, blah, 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 blah. And if we have any dispute about this kind of stuff, you know, the terms of this contract we are agreeing are handled under standard contract law as published by the ACE legal philosophy firm. You know, so everybody recognizes this company, ACE, publishes legal treatises on contract law, on employment law, on environmental law, on criminal law, on property law. So ACE has a bunch of legal scholars and former judges and former lawyers and blah, blah, blah. And that's what they do. They just publish documents summarizing their understanding of what the legal code is right now. They have all kinds of description of past cases so that practicing judges, when they need to make a decision, draw on the precedent as summarized, as codified by the documents published by this ACE company. So people, and there could be competing ones, so it's not just this uniform monolithic thing. There could be different things. That there could be this tradition over here that says, oh, with employee disputes, this is the way things get handled. There could be another tradition that says over here, no, this is how it gets handled. And so when you go to work at a firm, the firm just has to be clear up front. Our philosophy is we do things the way, you know, the Anakins did. And then some other firm says, oh, no, we do things the way the Obi-Wans did, referring to, like, the people who started this tradition. And then, and you sign, you're going to come work for me, you sign on the dotted line, you're agreeing that if we ever have a dispute over this contract and your performance, we are going to take it to a judge who's known in this field, and we'll say to him or her, we want you to handle this using the type of law published in this particular book by the ACE firm. Whereas some other company with an employee dispute would go to some other judge and say, we want you to handle the law as summarized by this different document, perhaps put out by ACE also. Okay, so they're the loser, the person that, you know, if the judge says, yeah, you know, this employee wasn't showing up for work and he was calling in as being sick, but actually he was going to a baseball game. So I rule that according to this principle and this legal book that you guys wanted me to use, the employer gets to not only not pay him for that day, but gets to dock him for a week pay on top of that as punishment, whereas some other treatise would have said, no, you only get to dock him for that one day. Then the loser, in a sense, the employee, is disappointed at the outcome, but in a sense, he agreed to that rule in the first place. So that's the sense in which it's a voluntary consent-based legal framework. He agreed to those rules up front, and it didn't go his way. So that's far different from the example I said about the kid who's born in the Native American tribe and likes climbing trees, and his elders just keep telling him, if you keep doing that, we're going to kill you. And he never agreed to that rule ever, and yet that's being imposed on him. So that's kind of customary. So now Christopher is asking me in that context now, what mechanism restrains customary law from making such a tax on rights? And so already, you know, Christopher, you're kind of loading the deck there. You're assuming that you know what everyone's rights are beforehand, and now you want to say, give me a society that minimizes violations of the things that I've decided a priori are people's rights. So I'm not saying what you're claiming is wrong or there's any problem with that, but I'm saying it sounds like you're going on the towards the side of the spectrum of Rothbard in thinking that you kind of know what the law needs to look like to be a just society, and you're just saying, I think the market could better approximate that than the government. So it's And perhaps that's the right way to think about law, but I'm just pointing out, notice that that's what you're doing, whereas you probably wouldn't talk like that if it came to food production. You know, you wouldn't say, how can we be sure that depoliticized food production is going to give people as much food as they have a right to? You see what I'm saying? You wouldn't talk like that as a free market economist. You would just say, well, let the market decide what it is, and if some people starve, that's unfortunate, but that's, you know, it probably won't happen. There'll be less starvation going on under market provision of food, but I can't guarantee that outcome, and even if it does happen, it's not that there's anything horrible going on, that's just the way the market outcome is. And it's a shame that people died from starving, but that's the way it's going to happen. You know, you wouldn't say, oh, the market violated their rights to food because you don't think they have rights to food. And you wouldn't know beforehand what needs to happen before you're willing to support the market outcome. There's kind of prima facie reasons that you, as a free market economist, would say it, the market outcome is what it is, and if you have a problem with that, like, you can donate food on the side or you can set up charities. So you get what I'm saying? So, like I said, I'm not going to try to answer your question too much more now because this is the kind of thing that's better handled during the objections phase. Okay, we got about 12 minutes just so you guys can pace yourselves. Let's see, am I missing anything here? Okay. So, Kyle Hale asks, A.L. Spence, you said, what two examples are they going to use? I don't know if you're talking to me or somebody else, but I'm not. I don't know what you're talking about there. It's addressed to me. Okay, Kyle says, since you and I think there will be no ANCAP society in the U.S., should people consider going the Jeff Berwick route, expatriating to some other country with an inefficient, weak government in which BS laws are not enforced and taxes can be ignored at least to some extent? Well, sure, people should consider it. I mean, that's the way you phrase your question. Should people consider it? Yeah, they should certainly consider it. I'm not saying that's the right answer for everybody. So, for example, people ask me, am I getting ready to leave the country? No, I'm not. But I was just talking to somebody last night, and I was telling that person, he was giving me his views on what he thought was coming down the pike and how he was thinking thinks martial law is coming and this, and I was saying, well, if you think that, you should leave, because he's pretty young and he's not married or anything. But for me, you know, I have a young son, and I think, you know, he's in a certain school right now. We've got a bunch of family here that clearly his, the rest of my family is staying here. And so I just think all things considered, I'm staying. And even if we do get martial law and this and that, that, okay, I mean, it's, I mean, I have religious views as well that say this world has fallen and I'm not going to find paradise on this earth anyway. So no matter where I am, people are going to be bad, and I might as well just stay here where I know, kind of understand how things work and understand the people and try to do the best I can from here. But that's not, but other people have other things. Like, I totally get Jim Rogers picking up and moving his kids so they can learn Chinese, and he thinks that that makes more sense. So if people understand Spanish, then, and they're young and they don't have any ties here, yeah, you probably should go to Mexico and consider going further south as you get your bearings. So it's, there's no one-size-fits-all answer, but definitely if what you want to do is minimize your personal interaction with coercive government, yeah, probably there's places on earth you want to be besides the United States over the next 20 years. Okay, Kevin Killinger asks, when will the Gary North strategy of shaming Krugman into baiting you be revealed or become apparent, and can you let us in on it if we promise to keep our mouths shut? No, I can't let you in on it. It would be revealed, well, it depends, because there's a lot of setup time for me. I don't know. I hope by October, the kind of what he was telling me I should do would be apparent. But I can't promise that. Okay. Susan L. asks me, assuming you hold the ANCAP philosophy, how do you vote? She has in parentheses, regardless of fed, state, local, end parentheses. If you believe that the current system is inherently corrupt, do you refuse to participate in a corrupt system by forfeiting your vote? But if you do, then you give up any power you have and they are still taking your money via taxes. Do you understand what I'm asking? Yeah, I totally understand what you're asking. So I personally don't vote. I decided that about, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, something like that. Maybe even longer. I'm getting all mixed up. There was a time when I did vote, and I would argue with people, and I thought it made sense to vote because I was saying, hey, we're not picking this system. It's been foisted on us. But now, the more I thought about it, I just decided not to. And so the thing for me is the crucial, there's two parts of the argument. By the way, before I get into this, though, let me say, if others vote, I don't think they're doing something immoral, because it's, they're not initiating force on somebody. They've had this system put on them. So, like, if you're in a concentration camp, this was the analogy I used to use when I voted. I used to say, look, if I'm in a concentration camp in World War II, and the Nazi guys come up to me and they say, okay, Murphy, since you're Jewish, we're going to kill you now. And I say, whoa, I'm not Jewish, I'm Irish Catholic. I'm not, by saying that, condoning the system. I'm not telling them, if I were Jewish, then it would be cool to kill me. I'm just saying, given these crazy rules you guys have in place, I'm pointing out you shouldn't kill me, according to your own rules. And so by the same token, if there's a referendum to raise property taxes and I go and vote against it, I'm not saying, oh, if 51% of us voted for it, then it would be cool and it makes sense to pay tax more of our property. I'm just saying, given these rules you've set up, I'm trying to do what I can to make sure you don't do the thing that I don't want you to do. So, got a situation developing here. So that's, be careful, don't fall. So that's the analogy I used to use, but the problem is, as I'm sure you guys are all well aware, there's a sense in which your vote doesn't matter. So, especially the larger the election you're talking about. So there is not, it is literally almost impossible that my vote will decide whether Mitt Romney or Obama is the next president. So I really don't need to worry about, oh gee, which one do I want to be in there or not, because I have almost no influence over that. Now it's through my voting. Now it's true, given the limited platform I have, I could influence what other people do, and that's why I talk about Ron Paul so much. So that strikes some people as a paradox, but I don't think it is. So I talk up Ron Paul, but yet I didn't vote for him, and I didn't even donate money to his campaign. Okay, and it's not because, oh, he wasn't good enough to get my money. It was, I just decided I'm not going to give money to people's campaign. Incidentally, in case people, I don't want to ever be considered a liar, my business partner and I did make a donation to Rand Paul's campaign because this guy we knew in Nashville was having a meet and greet, like where he had Rand Paul come in and then local Nashvillians when he was running, where was he, in Kentucky? You know, prominent people in the Nashville area who were real small government people showed up. And this guy, I think the way it works is probably he wrote a big check to the Rand Paul campaign. And so I was trying to not leave him hanging high and dry for this event he was doing. So that's why I relaxed my rule and said, okay, fine. So it was more to support my buddy. Anyway, I'm just saying that in case it somehow ever comes out that I donated money, people think I'm a liar. But in general, as far as I can remember, that's the only money I've ever given to a candidate. I've never even given a dime to Ron Paul, nor did I ever vote for any of these people, even in a primary. Okay, so I did vote in primaries when I was younger, when I thought voting made sense, but now I don't think that anymore. Okay, so so I could influence people that way. So then that's why, to me, it makes sense to write articles talking about Ron Paul, even though he's not my ideal candidate, right? If Ron Paul became president and still had a limited government that taxed people and did such and such, you know, I would say, well, that's not right. We can have a better society than that. But in the grand scheme of things, I throw my weight behind Ron Paul because he's so much better than the current crop of people that I'm being reasonable. So that's the way that I am realistic and not a purist and stick my head in the sand and hold out for perfection. But in terms of, but pragmatically, me driving down to the polls and voting or even getting an absentee ballot and doing it, that's not worth my time. Why would I do that? It'd be smarter for me to go buy a lotto ticket. And, you know, I'd have a better chance of some noticeable gain that way than going and voting. So that's the way I handle that. And the funny thing is, people will come back and they'll say, oh, you're thinking about these narrow terms. What if everybody did that? And then say, yeah, that would be great if everybody did that. If nobody voted, then the system would collapse, I think. So, or at the very least, if you're going to vote for someone who's very close to your ideal candidate. Or, you know, write in Lou Rockwell or Judge Napolitano or something. But what makes no sense whatsoever is for you to go and vote for either the Democrat or Republican saying, well, he's slightly better than the other guy. That makes no sense because your vote isn't putting him in one way or the other. And if you then use the principle, I want to do what I wish everyone else would do, then don't vote for Romney or Obama. You would go vote for some real pure candidate. And then if everyone did what you did, then that guy would be in office. Right? So that's the thing. When people, they make a pragmatic argument, like, well, it's not going to be one of those guys. It's going to either be Romney or Obama, so you got to vote for one of them. And so they say, okay, on your own terms, pragmatically, my vote isn't going to matter, so I shouldn't do that. And then they try to make a principle. So, well, if everyone did that, and says, okay, so then I should do what I want everyone to do. I don't want everyone to vote for Obama or Romney, so why would I vote for them if I'm going to take the principled approach? Right? So that's kind of the way I analyze these things. Okay, we got time for one more. Let's see, let me do an easy one. Jeff Leskovar says, did Mises ever address the issue of minarchism versus anarchism? If so, why did he object to the anarchist position? Okay, we get that one a lot. To my knowledge, Mises never talked about Murray Rothbard's strain of anarcho-capitalism. To my knowledge, he never said what said it was good or bad. In Human Action, and I think maybe elsewhere, Mises does criticize anarchism. But if you read what he says things like, it's an unfortunate aspect of reality that there needs to be an agency that punishes lawbreakers, that we can't just sit back and not protect property rights, that there would be antisocial individuals who would wreck the market economy through their violence and harm to other people's bodies if we didn't have an agency that could then punish them and contain them, either deterring them or physically putting them in jail or killing them. That we need to be able to neutralize those threats. So really, when you look through there, what Mises is objecting to is pacifism. And so really what Mises is saying is you need to have law enforcement, and he kind of just took it for granted that that's what the government does. So Mises clearly was not an anarchist. And anybody who says he was an anarchist is being a little bit fuzzy with you. I mean, there was a sense, the only argument you could possibly make is that Mises in one of his works, the title is escaping me, maybe Nation, State, and Economy, he's talking about federalism, the concept of federalism, and he says you want to allow for secession, you want to like distribute government power to lower levels, you don't want to have a concentrated centralized power, you want to distribute to lower levels, and in order to keep the system from getting out of hand, people should be able to secede. So if smaller units want to break away from the larger unit, they should be allowed to go in peace, and that will be a healthy thing that will, you know, keep the bigger governments from getting too oppressive, because then they would just know the smaller units would separate. And he doesn't ever really talk about where the dividing line is, but if you took that principle to its logical fruition, you could say, well, using that principle, then Mises agrees, ultimately, even the individual household should be able to secede from the local city government and then have your own government that the owner of the house imposes on just the land on his property. So in that sense, you could argue that Mises' views culminated in anarcho-capitalism. But Mises never said that. All right. So I'm saying he explicitly denounced anarchism in several places, said that the government is necessary as the agency that beats people into submission if they violate the law and violate property rights. And the only way you can kind of come up with an argument for anarchism in Mises' thought is to take his principle of secession and apply it farther than he himself ever applied it. So that's – but like I said, having said all that, it's clear when you look at Mises' objection to anarchism, he's not objecting to Murray Rothbard anarchism. Mises doesn't say, as far as I know, the free market wouldn't work with police and militaries. He never actually says that. He just says you need to have law enforcement, because if you didn't have that, then criminals would be running rampant. So Mises never says you need to have law enforcement provided by the state, because law enforcement provided by the market wouldn't work for some reason. Whereas Ayn Rand did come out and say that. Ayn Rand did clearly say why she thought you couldn't have market provision of legal and defense services, because she thought, you know, you need to have a final court of appeal and that kind of stuff. And there needs to be a single legal code. You can't have multiple legal codes. It doesn't make any sense, that kind of stuff. All right, let me stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in. And I will see you all on Wednesday.